I am here with Rutger Bregman. Rutger, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Yeah, it's nice to finally connect with you. I've been seeing your stuff for a while and just read your book, your newest book, which is Moral Ambition, which is a little bit of a departure in tone. But you've also written Utopia for Realists and Humankind. This is much more of a call to action, and I want to talk about the call. You've also started the School for Moral Ambition, which I want to talk about. But before we jump into the book, how would you summarize your focus as a historian and just as someone who comes to all these topics we're going to talk about?
So my whole career, I've been fascinated by history. I studied history at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And initially, I was a bit frustrated by academia. You know, it seemed so insulated. I had this dream once of becoming a professor. And then maybe when I was 50 or 60, I would finally be allowed to write about the big, interesting questions of history, like why have we conquered the globe? Why did the Industrial Revolution start in England, in the West? Why not in India or China, for example? Those were the kind of books that I really loved, you know, Jared Diamond, for example, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Yeah. But it started to dawn on me that I would probably have to, you know, specialize first and, you know, spent 4 years of my life writing a PhD, which on the one hand seemed really interesting. But then on the other hand, I looked at all the PhDs that had recently been published at Utrecht University, and I found all of them really boring. So I thought, you know what, let's go into journalism. But then I found that to be quite frustrating as well. You know, the relentless focus on breaking news, on what happens today instead of what happens every day. And then when I was 25, I got my lucky break. It was a new journalism platform that was founded in the Netherlands called The Correspondent. And these guys, the founders, had a bit of a different news philosophy. They wanted to unbreak the news. And they said, Rutger, you can come and work here and write about whatever you want and focus more on the structural forces that, you know, govern our society. So finally, I could write about all kinds of hobbies of mine. For example, universal basic income. That was something that had long fascinated me. It seemed to me a really exciting idea that moves beyond the traditional political divide of the left versus the right. So as I said, that was my lucky break. That's how I got started. And ever since then, The Correspondent was my platform, my little laboratory where I could develop my ideas. So that's one of the benefits of not being a native speaker is that you have your own focus group, a tiny country that no one gives a shit about. Mm-hmm. And you can test out ideas, see what works, see what doesn't. And so that's how I've been writing my books for the past decade. First as essays for Dutch readers, and then, reiterating, learning, changing my mind. And then at some point, you're like, yeah, this is a book. Let's write it.
So again, I think we're going to mostly talk about moral ambition, but big picture, how would you describe the state of the world from your point of view? I mean, there's so much is happening in American politics. I mean, and it has so many global implications. We've basically, to my eye, we've created an emergency for much of the world, at least optically. It remains to be seen what's going to happen. You probably finished this book about a year ago, I would imagine. What's your view of the current situation?
So the first line of my very first book, Utopia for Realists, was that in the past, everything was worse. You know, when we zoom out, we see that we've made tremendous progress in many respects. I mean, you know this, right? The massive decline of child mortality, of extreme poverty, especially since the 1980s, progress has been speeding up. So that is wonderful news. And this was more than a decade ago when I was a bit frustrated that it seemed we had arrived at the end of history, and most of my friends on the political left, they mainly knew what they were against growth, against austerity, against the establishment. But they didn't really know what the next big thing was going to be. So in that book, I wanted to say, like, come on, let's think about what could be the new utopian milestone. There's this beautiful quote from Oscar Wilde, who once wrote that, you know, a map without utopia on it is not worth even glancing at because it leaves out the one island where humanity is always landing. Now, I guess I got what I wished for. Things are not boring anymore, but not really the direction I had hoped for, I guess. So I've always loved this statement from Max Roser from Our World in Data, you know, the fantastic website that collects all the data on the state of the world, basically. And I think it's just correct that on the one hand, the world is really bad. We could do so much better. The world has become better. That's also true. We have made progress. And Yeah, it's all of that at the same time, I would say. I, just like you, I'm really, really terrified of what's going on in the United States right now. Things are also happening quicker than I expected. And yeah, it's one of the big lessons of history, right? There's nothing inevitable about the way we structured our society right now. It can radically change, and sometimes quite quickly, both for the better and for the worse.
Yeah, well, we'll come back around to existential concerns, because I think one of the ways in which things are always getting better analysis has left people dissatisfied. I'm thinking in particular the kinds of criticism and distortion Steven Pinker had to face when he released his books on this topic. I mean, Steven certainly was not arguing that progress is inevitable. He was just asking us to acknowledge how much progress we've obviously made, very much based on the kinds of data you referenced. But many of us perceive more and more acutely how much potential energy is stored up in the system and how destructive it could be on so many fronts. I mean, you know, AI is the latest wrinkle here. But the idea that we could just needlessly destroy the possibility of building a something like a utopia, I mean, that certainly seems within reach if we could just iron out our political problems sideline a few prominent sociopaths. But yeah, we do seem on the verge of screwing a lot of it up, you know, quite needlessly. So we'll talk about that. I'll come back around to that.
Yeah, I guess if I can say one thing, please, about that, Sam. So the shape of history is just really, really weird. So in my new book, Moral Ambition, I have this one graph where I ask this simple question: what was the most important thing that happened in all of human history?
Yeah.
And there are a couple of candidates, right? Maybe it was the birth of the Buddha or Jesus or Muhammad. Maybe it was the rise and fall of the great empires, you know, the Roman Empire, the Aztec Empire. Maybe it was the invention of the wheel. Maybe it was the invention of the compass. I mean, there are so many candidates. But then you just look at some simple graphs: growth of GDP, decline of extreme poverty, growth of carbon emissions. And all these graphs have basically the same shape, right? You see the hockey stick that starts in 1750, mm-hmm, and it's a rocket that has been launched ever since. And it seems to be the case that we are, you know, looking at a movie, or actually we're participating in a movie, and we are nearing the climax, you know, when the music is swelling, and we have no idea how this is going to end. It could be that the rocket totally crashes quite soon, and that the story will be over quite soon, or we will break out and colonize the Milky Way, and maybe we will be able to build some kind of utopia. And then our ancestors will look back on us and say, gosh, these people were the Asians, right? That is so weird about being alive today, is that we basically have a front row seat to the greatest show in all of human history, and we don't know how it's going to end.
Yeah, this is a point you make toward the end of the book when you you point out, you know, quite accurately, that the chronocentrism the of past generations, the idea that every generation imagines that it's living at an especially significant time, has almost always been delusional. Mm-hmm. And yet, at this moment, it's very hard to persuade ourselves that something isn't unique about this moment. I mean, again, AI is the development in recent years that has sharpened that up especially. But even prior to that, the pace of change and the kind of the asymptotic nature of it, and again, the reference in the graphs you cited, the difference between getting things close to right and getting them catastrophically wrong in this generation seems especially important.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I find hope in the knowledge that we've been in really scary times in our history, and also really immoral times in our history, when there was a countercultural revolt of elites against the prevailing immorality of their time. So in the book, I write a lot about the British abolitionists, the late 18th century, who revolted against the elites who were in power back then. So this was a time of huge alcoholism in Parliament, you know, politicians slurring their speeches. One in five women was a prostitute in London. You had the Prince of Wales, who was an extraordinary prick, even by royal standards. And then there was a movement of people like Thomas Clarkson and William Wilberforce, who said, we are going to make doing good fashionable once again. And abolitionism was just a part of that. That was one of the main projects. I think we've seen something similar in the United States with the move from the Gilded Age to the Progressive Era. You know, again, the Gilded Age extraordinary inequality. These robber barons who have made insane amounts of money with their monopolies in railroads, for example, and they started spending the money in the most crazy ways. You know, the Vanderbilts, for example, built these huge mansions on Fifth Avenue in New York. There was this one mansion where they recreated Venice inside the mansion with the canals, etc. Really bizarre. But then again, there was a countercultural movement against it of elites, actually. People like Theodore Roosevelt, the progressive president, or people like Louis Brandeis, who became the people's lawyer and ended up on the Supreme Court. One of my favorite persons from this era is a woman called Elva Vanderbilt, who married into this Vanderbilt family and initially really wanted to become part of the 400 in New York, like the richest 400 families in New York, who spent the most money on the most silly things. But then, she divorced. She had a lot of money and became a pretty radical suffragette, an advocate for women's rights, and donated a huge amount of money to the women's rights movement. Almost a little bit like Mackenzie Scott is doing today, the wife of Jeff Bezos. So I guess that's what I'm calling for in this new book, is that, again, we need a countercultural movement, especially that now that things are getting a bit dark and we see so many examples of just blatant immorality. I mean, in the U.S., the whole Republican Party is basically in a state of moral collapse. You know, I've got two young kids, and it's not, for me, it's not really left versus right anymore. It's when I think about how I want to raise my kids, it's pretty much the opposite of how these people in power are behaving, like so nasty and basically like bullies all the time. But as I said, we've been here before, and there have been cases in history when we overcame it.
Don't you know they're making America great again? What about that project don't you like, Rutger? That's
it depends on what particular reference you have. Yeah. I mean, as you know, I'm an advocate of tax fairness. I think it's quite unfair that billionaires around the globe have lower effective tax rates than working class people and middle class people. I think that this can be fixed, and that there are beautiful historical examples in history, actually, in the 1950s and the 60s, when we had a much more reasonable system of taxation and actually also higher growth rates. So yeah, make America great again. Yeah, I see some inspiration there in the past, definitely.
Well, let's talk about what is aspirational here. I mean, one of the points you make in the book is that moral ambition is contagious, right? That this is what you want is to find a mode of life that is not just a masochistic, right, and merely moralistic, but you want something that is that people aspire to because it's just obviously good. I mean, it seems to me that the whole point of our being here ultimately is to make life worth living, and once we've done that, to continue to refine it and safeguard it and just make the possibilities of human happiness more and more beautiful, and to spread the wealth around, obviously, right? I mean, the thing that is so excruciating is the level of inequality in our world, and how this inequality, you know, you can, whatever delusions you take on board with respect to being self-made, I mean, any 5-minute analysis of really anyone's situation reveals that it's, at bottom, it really is all a matter of luck. I mean, people are extraordinarily lucky not to be born in some failed state where they have the opportunity only to, you know, get killed at an early age or spectacularly injured, or to die of some, you know, tropical disease that we haven't suffered in the developed world for quite some time. So much of your discussion here is focused on being motivated by these disparities, to find them morally intolerable, very much in the spirit of in which someone like Peter Singer has argued. I mean, you acknowledge in the book that you can't merely castigate people and demand that everyone sacrifice. There's something aspirational about this, and I think we need to focus on that, because there's, you know, even some of your past pronouncements, I mean, the moments for which you became famous. I mean, I think that probably the biggest one was when you were at Davos castigating the billionaires for having, you know, all flown there on private jets. I think you said that something like 1,500 private jets had flown into that meeting.
And then they cry when they see David Attenborough's film, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
It's quite
a
funny experience. I was in the auditorium.
Is on the menu, yeah. But my concern there is that you can be read or heard as merely demonizing wealth, You know, in the limit, in success, what we want is the wealth to be spread around such that the poorest people on earth live the way the richest people do now, you know, 100 years from now. I mean, something like that, whatever is compatible with physics is something we want to aspire to. So I don't think we want to be saying at the end of the day that wealth is the problem.
Yeah, I can't agree more.
Yeah.
And the left used to understand that. So social democracy, I see myself as an old-fashioned social democrat. So I think in the 60s and the 70s, the left was the party of progress, right? It was the party of growth, of innovation, of building. Today, you have ideologies like degrowth, for example, that to me seem to demonize wealth or luxury or whatever. And I'm like, no, like we're way too poor. We should become much richer. And then indeed, as you say, spread it around. The very first essay I ever wrote was when I was 16 years old. I had this epiphany as the son of a preacher. You know, I grew up in the church. And, you know, this is an age when you start thinking about, what do I actually believe? Do I agree with all the dogmas that are served to me? And I wrote this essay about free will. Like, came to the conclusion that, like, doesn't make sense at all. Like, surely it can't exist. And I guess that argument will resonate with you.
Yeah.
And I guess ever from that young age, that has also always been something that has driven me. Whenever we talk about inequality, I think it's especially important to zoom out, right? If you live in a rich country like I do in the Netherlands, or I'm currently living in New York, you're already part of the richest 3.5% in the world. So when we talk about inequality, we mainly have to talk about global inequality. And the world needs so much more growth in that respect, right? And I'm pretty optimistic that we can make that happen, and that we have already made quite a bit of progress in the last couple of decades. But yeah, I can't agree more that this idea that, I don't know, it's so anti-human in a way. This is quite dominant, maybe also in environmental circles, the idea that humans are a plague or something like that, that we are a virus, that we are just bad. And that is just something I've always deeply, deeply disagreed with.
Well, so let's get into the details, because I suspect my tolerance for inequality is more capacious than yours, at least by tendency. I mean, it's not clear to me that if we could spread the wealth around completely, immediately, that would be the right solution. I mean, this is one of the arguments, really the only argument for open borders, the idea that your borders, national borders, and the inequalities they enshrine are totally unjustifiable ethically. And so people should be free to move everywhere. And when I look at the consequences of that, what I imagine would happen is that, okay, people would move more or less everywhere until there was no reason to move anywhere, because everywhere was just as mediocre as everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And I come back to this notion of aspiration. I do think we want societies that are wealthy enough so as to sustain scientific advancement and artistic expression at the highest level, and everything we celebrate as technological and cultural success in the developed world, when we're not distracting ourselves by pointless conflict. So the question is, how does, if we agree that we wanted to maintain that, you know, if we want New York City to be a beautiful, high functioning city, right? And yet Peter Singer's analysis wouldn't allow us to prioritize anything in New York today, because life in sub-Saharan Africa is so bad. All of those resources should obviously go there. How do you square that? How would you, I mean, if you could just start allocating funds where they should go, would you follow Peter Singer, or would you have a different calculus?
Quite different. So on the one hand, I deeply admire the man. He's one of the great philosophers of our time.
Yep.
And there's also a lot to like about the movement that he co-founded, you know, these effective altruists. They've gotten a lot of bad press recently, especially since the SBF fiasco. But on the other hand, there's a lot to admire about them. I guess as someone who comes from the political left, what I like most about them is their moral seriousness, the willingness to actually practice what they preach. So if I go to, I don't know, a conference of a bunch of leftists, I don't see a lot of people giving a lot of money away. I see a lot of people talking about the need for systemic change and overthrowing the patriarchy and, you know, destroying capitalism or whatever. But very often they don't take a lot of individual responsibility. But if you go to an effective altruist conference, you will meet a lot of people who have donated kidneys to random strangers. Mm-hmm. Now, I gotta admit, I still have both of my kidneys, sorry to say.
Yeah,
but I admire the people who do that and who give a really substantial part of their income to highly effective charities. I think just like you, I became a member of Giving What We Can, and mm-hmm. that has been a pretty transformational experience for me personally. It really changed my outlook on life when I started donating a much more substantial part of my income and the money that I had made with my books. So that's what I really admire. What I don't really like is, I guess, the focus on guilt. I think EA got started in the 2010s when a lot of people who I like to describe as born altruists, people who were basically always that way, already when they were young, they turned vegan and gave away, you know, the money they got from their parents to charity. They basically discovered each other in that era when social media got started. And that's how the movement got going. And I think that's beautiful, but it's not for most people. So I couldn't take most of my friends to an EA conference because it's just too weird, right? It's yeah. a lot of people who yeah. are somewhere on the spectrum or at least neurodiverse, which is great, right? Which is EA should just continue being EA. But I think there's a lot of room for a different kind of movement that taps into different sources of motivation. I'm personally a pluralist. I care about many things in life. I'm motivated by, well, altruism and empathy, definitely, but also motivated by other things, maybe enthusiasm, maybe even a bit of vanity. And I think that's fine to be motivated by multiple things. What we're trying to do with our organization, the School for More Ambition, and also what I'm calling for in the book is to once again make doing good high status, to basically say, like, if you are one of those most talented, ambitious people in the world, then you shouldn't work for McKinsey. You shouldn't work for Goldman Sachs. You should be working on the most pressing issues we face as a species. And we are trying to ground this movement not in guilt, right? We don't want to see drowning children everywhere. You know, the famous thought experiment from Peter Singer, where he said, the shallow pond. Well, I guess most of your listeners will know about that, so I won't repeat the story. Yeah. But yeah, I've never really liked that. It always came across as moral blackmail to me. Like, now suddenly I'm supposed to see drowning kids everywhere when I take a sip from my coffee, right? Mm-hmm. That I probably shouldn't have bought because it was too expensive. Yeah, I've never really liked that. I would prefer to be part of a movement that is grounded in enthusiasm and excitement of, yeah, just the simple fact that we can make this world a wildly better place. Mm-hmm. And that it's just really cool to be part of a small group of very dedicated idealists who want to take on some of these challenges.
All right, so let's take the extreme case here. Let's take somebody like Bill Gates, who obviously lives extraordinarily well. He, you know, flies around in a private plane, which he almost certainly owns. He probably has more than one. And he spends a fantastic amount of money on himself. He has homes all over the place. Again, I can only presume. I don't actually know Bill. But assuming he lives like most billionaires, he spends a lot of money, you know, more than thousands of people in the developing world, maybe more than tens of thousands of people in the developing world on himself. The question is, how much should we begrudge him or anyone living that way with having amassed those kinds of resources? In Bill's case, I mean, so you can, in the case of the prototypically selfish billionaire, I think that we can get to begrudging pretty quickly. But in Bill's case, he's been really probably the most philanthropic person, if not merely of his generation, of any generation. You know, his personal quirks aside, again, I don't know him, I just know what I read. He's done a tremendous amount of good in the world. And when I think about what is optimal for Bill, it's hard for me to see that the sight of him struggling to figure out how to check his luggage at the, you know, the Southwest counter of an airport, it's hard to see that how that's optimal. So do you think he should be flying commercially? Or do you think that if he saves time flying private, where he's free to think about the next thing, next disease he wants to cure, if he found flying commercially as onerous as many people do, if he would be reluctant to travel to that conference mm-hmm. where he might meet the person whose project he would fund, et cetera, you see the mm-hmm. knock-on effects here. I mean, my intuition is we want Bill being Bill as freely and as happily as possible in a way that's commensurate with him being as inspired as possible to help the world in all the ways he's been helping it of late.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to say about this. A lot of people indeed will know me for saying some nasty things about billionaires when I went to Davos and also being quite critical of billionaire philanthropy.
Yeah.
And I think there's a good reason for that. A lot of philanthropy is just really unimpressive. You know, it's boring people giving a lot of money to have their name on an already well-funded museum or a university or whatever. You know, let's give Harvard more money. And I've always found that pretty sad. At the same time, as a historian, I know that there are beautiful exceptions. I mean, we talked about the abolitionists. The abolitionists weren't funded by the government. They didn't get government subsidies. They didn't have fancy corporate partnerships. No, they needed brave philanthropists, people like the Secret Six in the United States or Garrett Smith, the richest man in New York at the time, who gave a huge amount of money to the abolitionists. And, you know, that was actually very risky for him as well. He funded the raid on Harper's Ferry. So philanthropy can be incredibly powerful if you use it to fund really important and neglected and sometimes also quite unpopular issues. We've got another great foundation currently, Open Philanthropy. I think just like Bill Gates, they deserve a lot of credit for working on things that are sadly quite unpopular or that people just find boring. In my book, I've got a quite extensive discussion on malaria. 600,000 people die from malaria every year. That's 10 times as much as how many people die from natural disasters. So you could argue, just in terms of death and suffering, it's an order of magnitude bigger than climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, pretty much I have no progressive friends who care all that much about it. People seem to not know about it or forgotten about it. And just the moral catastrophe goes on and on and on. And we see development aid getting slashed around the globe, and it's not just Trump doing it, but it's also happening in the UK. It's also happening in the Netherlands, where I'm from. So then I think people like Bill deserve quite some credit for doing the unpopular or unsexy thing. He's played a historical role in the development of malaria vaccines and has spent an enormous amount of money on accelerating the fight against that disease. So I would much rather live in a different kind of world, you know, where we would have perhaps better funded government, where development aid would be more popular, and that would be the way in which we can tackle those problems. Yeah. But we don't live in that kind of utopia. We don't live in that perfect society. So in the meantime, I'm very glad that people like Bill Gates do what they do, and they can, I'm happy for them to fly on their private jet if that makes them more effective. If I've got one thing on my wish list. I mean, some of these billionaires, including Bill, also say that they're also in favor of systemic change. They're also in favor of, you know, what we talked about, a more reasonable system of taxation. They sometimes even come out and say that. In a recent Netflix documentary, for which I was also invited to contribute, Mr. Gates said that he, in a more just society, would own just a third of what he currently owns.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, okay, but then also put your money where your mouth is there. So fund, you know, an effective lobby to make that happen, to make that a bigger priority, for example, among Democrats, which I think, by the way, could also be very politically effective. I think that kind of economic populism should be part of a winning Democratic agenda because the vast majority of people are already in favor of that. Even most Republicans think that we need a more reasonable tax system that taxes wealth a bit more and labor a bit less. So I guess that's the one thing. But I, you know, always when people dunk on Bill Gates, I'm like, we got to be dunking on all these philanthropists who have all their vanity projects, yeah. Or we got to be dunking on people who don't do anything at all. And that's the majority of them. So
yeah.
No, I mean, Bill Gates is really not my big enemy.
When you look at the amount of money that the richest people give away, it's just a rounding error on a rounding error. Usually, yeah. I mean, Bill and I guess Warren Buffett are exceptions there. I mean, they've given, you know, billions of dollars away now rather than just merely pledging it at the end of their lives. You know, in their cases, many, many billions. And I guess Mackenzie Scott is doing the same. But, you know, we might debate the validity of some of the causes. But I mean, one of the things that many of us learn from effective altruism, you know, taking, you know, recent embarrassments, holding them to the side, is that, and this is actually something you say explicitly in your book, that empathy is overrated, right? That the cause that gives you the good feels for which you most naturally you have an emotional response isn't necessarily the one that is most pressing in the world or about which we have a remedy that can do the most good, right?
And so, absolutely.
So yeah. There's a kind of a dispassionate analysis required here, and you know, and I share your enthusiasm for the Against Malaria Foundation, and I'm happy that it became so prominent in EA circles, because otherwise I wouldn't have known about it. But I just noticed, as much as I thought about it, I just couldn't get excited about malaria as a cause. And so I just defaulted to systematizing my giving to it. I mean, I just decided to give to it, despite the fact that it's not the thing I naturally cared about, and, you know, kind of gave to it much more than I otherwise would have had I just been guided to, by my own moral intuitions. So I think EA has made that contribution, just the idea that you have to notice your emotional life as a separate piece of information. It's not nothing, but it's, mm-hmm. it's certainly not everything. The biggest contribution to my own life there is just, and you referenced the giving pledge, has just been deciding in advance how much money I want to give, mm-hmm. you know, what percent of my earnings I want to give each year, and to be committed to that, because then you're no longer vulnerable to your inspiration or lack thereof. I mean, you can always give more, but you can't give less, right? And this is what kind of backstops your selfishness and your preoccupation with superficial things. And you can obviously ratchet it further and in the direction of generosity and commit to more, as many people in the EA community do. And I think that's just all to the good, you know, despite the other questions I think you and I both share about EA's approach to these things.
Yeah, absolutely. At the same time, though, I do think that there are certain emotions or desires we can use to push people in the direction of doing much more good. Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk quite extensively about one of my favorite abolitionists, Thomas Clarkson. He was a student at Cambridge University in 1785, participated in an essay contest about the question, is it okay to own and sell other human beings? And the reason he participated, because he was ambitious. Right? He wanted to become a famous writer. He saw a career for himself in the Church of England. Then he wrote that essay, won first prize, went to Cambridge, to the Senate House. There was a beautiful ceremony for him. Then he went back to London on his horse. And then there was a famous moment when he was near the village of Wade's Mill, when he steps off his horse. And he keeps thinking about these questions in the essay. And he's like, but if this is actually true, what I've just written, that slavery is immoral, deeply immoral, then shouldn't someone do something about it? So you read his memoirs, and part of you thinks, well, Thomas Clarkson, you're quite the humble brag, or you're quite full of yourself, because suddenly he could see himself as the world historical hero who would take on the fight against the slave trade and against slavery. And a couple of weeks later, he joined a small group of abolitionists in the village of Teston, and he made this pledge, indeed, just like the giving pledge, but in this case, he said, I am going to devote the rest of my life fighting slavery and fighting the slave trade. The whole point is not that he was maybe a little bit of a vain man. The whole point is he did it. So he did spend 60 years of his life fighting slavery. He traveled 35,000 miles across the United Kingdom, spreading his abolitionist propaganda everywhere. And in the end, that transformed him as a person. You know, he became a very wise and quite humble man. In the end, he was buried in an unmarked grave, according to the Quaker tradition. So I think we can use the full spectrum of human emotions mm-hmm. and motivations. And if people in their early 20s, you know, want to make a name for themselves, are a bit ambitious, maybe a bit vain, and then that's fine. We should just channel that energy in the right direction. And currently, a lot of that energy is sadly going to waste.
You talk a lot about wasted talent. Mm-hmm. Give me your summary of that problem. I mean, I guess things have changed of late, but historically, had you stepped on the campus of one of our best universities like Stanford or Harvard or mm-hmm. MIT and declared that more or less everyone in sight was wasting their talent, that would seem like a non sequitur, and yet not on your account.
So I was at Harvard yesterday to speak to students about moral ambition, and it was a really interesting experience. On the one hand, you have this campus, you know, full of leftists, obviously. There was, again, another Gaza protest going on. Mm. On the other hand, we know that about 40-45% of graduates end up working in what a friend of mine who studied at Oxford calls the Bermuda Triangle of talent. Mm. So that's finance, corporate law, and consultancy. Yeah, you could ask some questions about the allocation of talent here. Like, do we really need our quote-unquote best and brightest to go to Wall Street or to go and work for McKinsey? Is that really rational? Is that logical? Shouldn't these really bright, ambitious young people be taking on some of the great challenges we face, whether that's the threat of the next pandemic or extreme poverty or the power of big tobacco. I mean, there's a lot of work to do, right? So it's quite a lot of fun to talk to those young students and to figure out, like, what's going wrong here? Why do they go in a certain direction? And a lot of my friends on the left would say, like, look, these people are just selling out. They're just a bunch of hypocrites. They're just going for the money. And then at some point, you know, the golden handcuffs tighten and then they're lost. That's not really my analysis. You know, speaking to most of these students, I think that most of them are quite genuine, that they do deeply care about some of the big issues that we face. It's just that they're really insecure at the same time. They're insecure overachievers, right? They're always looking for what is the next most prestigious thing. Mm. And today, too often, I think doing good or being an ambitious idealist is not really all that prestigious, right? It's not where the smartest kids go. So how many people go and work for great nonprofits when they leave Harvard or Stanford or whatever? It's a very small percentage, sadly, which is weird because many of these nonprofits work on much more interesting causes than, you know, the PowerPoints that you'll make at McKinsey. So in the book, I think really hard about how we can solve this dilemma. And at the same time, as I said, we founded this School for Moral Ambition to try and build a magnet for these talented people. We organize these fellowships that are deliberately highly exclusive and very hard to get into to help people pivot their career and to work on some of these most pressing issues.
Mm. Well, one of the problems in the nonprofit sector is that there's a taboo around getting rich working there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so you, by definition, you're filtering against the people who also want to live very well. And many of those people are disproportionately smart. And you're stigmatizing as just rank greed anyone who would want to get paid a ton of money, you know, running a nonprofit, whatever they accomplish in the world. What's so strange about that? I mean, it's understandable because you're immediately seeing that those funds could be used for, you know, to feed more hungry kids, say. But what's strange is that we celebrate spectacular wealth. I mean, culturally, we celebrate it when it comes from, you know, professional sports or in the, you know, in Hollywood or entertainment. You know, Taylor Swift does a tour that breaks all records. You know, she earns billions of dollars in a single year. And that there's almost nobody, I mean, maybe on the far left, people are vilifying her for that. But generally speaking, people celebrate that. And yet, if someone got analogously wealthy by curing cancer, right, or by feeding millions of starving people, you know, in some far-flung country, people would oppose their affluence with the cause and say there's something morally hypocritical here. Why would you have kept any of that money for yourself if you could have done more good? And so strangely, we have more or less declared in advance that we don't want our moral heroes to live like our most successful people. And therefore, we've divorced that component of status from, you know, moral entrepreneurship on some level.
Yeah, and that is deeply annoying. I can't agree more. Also, this silly obsession that some people have with the overhead of charities. I don't give a damn about what the percentage of money is that a charity gives to overhead. What really matters is what happens with the money, right? What are the actual effects, the results? Show me that. And maybe, you know, a 10% overhead is reasonable. Maybe it's 40% for some overheads, for some from charities. Yep. There's one study that I reference in the book. It's a Swiss study in which people were asked to judge the morality of certain industries. And then on the other axis of the graph, they show the hourly wage. And there's a very disturbing correlation here in the sense that the more immoral we judge an industry to be, the more money you can make. With, you know, famous examples, obviously, like the tobacco industry or the gambling industry, or one of the reasons they have to pay higher wages because it's just quite shameful to work there. So if they want to attract talent, they really need to pay more. Obviously, we would much rather live in a different kind of society. Another study from two Dutch economists asked a lot of people around the globe in more than 40 countries. It's a data set of 100,000 people in which people were asked, what do you think about your own job? Is it socially meaningful, yes or no? Or put differently, what would happen if you go on strike, right? What is the social value here? And it turns out around 25% of people in modern economies think that their own job, or at least doubt the value of their job, right? It's 8%. It's really sure that their job is socially meaningless, and 17% is in doubt. So that adds up to 25%. I think that's enormous. That's like five times the unemployment rate. And it's a lot of people who have excellent resumes, who went to great universities, who indeed make quite a lot of money. And if you then look at the different categories of jobs here, yeah, as you would suspect, for example, marketeers or bankers, consultants, they score quite highly, while firefighters or police officers, basically, they have yet to find the first firefighter who thinks his own job is socially. Yeah, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
One very interesting thing here, by the way, maybe also in this era of DOGE that's criticizing the government for being so inefficient, is that actually there are three times as many socially meaningless jobs in the private sector as in the public sector. Mm-hmm. So people are much more likely to consider their own job BS when they work for a private company instead of the government, which sort of makes sense if you think about it, because the government provides all these essential services like government and healthcare. And again, I'm the old-fashioned social democrat here. I think we should try and reverse that. I think many of these essential jobs, as we called them during the pandemic, should be much better paid. And that's why we need this more reasonable system of taxation. So that also, in that way, we make these jobs higher status. Money matters. It is one of the ways in which we show appreciation for other people and where we say, hey, this is important and that's less important. So I think we can learn from other governments here, like Finland or famously Singapore, that pays its civil servants much higher salaries. And we're also for top graduates from the best universities there. Yeah, the coolest thing is to go and work for government. That's the kind of world I would like to live in. Where at the same time, obviously, people can build beautiful companies, make a lot of money, and then give most of it away. That's also cool. I guess if I again compare myself to the effective altruists, I spoke to, for this book also, to a couple of effective altruists who live on such small salaries, you know, in the center of London for, I don't know, what is it, like 15K or 20K a year, or sometimes below the poverty line.
Yeah.
And like, people, I mean, I admire you, but you don't have to push it so far. You can just live a decent middle-class or upper-middle-class lifestyle. But I think for any rational person, at some point it's enough, right? You can only drive one car at a time. And sure, you can buy a boat, but how many times will you even be on the boat? You could also just rent a boat when you want it. For me, it's always been obvious that at some point there are very clear diminishing returns to more wealth. And it actually becomes also much more exciting to start giving it away. You and I both experienced that after taking the pledge of giving what we can. It's brought me a lot of happiness, actually, to not have the money in the bank anymore, but to see it working in the world. It's a little bit like your stocks portfolio, right? It's not that the money is away. No, I've got a whole portfolio of the things I've given, and I know that that money is working right now. It's doing good.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's just another category of wealth. I mean, you have this opportunity to help, and it's exciting to be confronted by that. You know, it's just, it just feels, I mean, it's something I spoke about with Will McCaskill in several conversations, and you actually reference this in the book, just to see it as an opportunity as opposed to see it as a you know, guilt you're atoning for, right? You have an, Will's example is, you know, if you could run into a burning building and rescue a child, you know, if you do that single act would probably be the most indelible moment of moral engagement in your entire life, right? And yet, you know, a few moments of thought reveals that you can cut a check today, which effectively does the same thing. And the question is, how can you make that more emotionally salient such that, or failing that, how can you just commit to doing that knowing that it's the right thing to do and that it will feel good the more you meditate on it? Back to this issue of, this really goes into the bucket of aspiration, that I have the same concern about the norm advocated by effective altruists, which is, follows directly from Peter Singer's shallow pond argument, which is, you should live at sort of the minimum standard that's pragmatic or sustainable for yourself and give everything else away. And I understand how they got there, and yet it seems not pragmatic for at least two reasons to me. One is that it is just not aspirational. It's not attractive. You're not going to walk through the quad at Harvard announcing this life project and get lots of people clamoring to subscribe, because it's just most people don't want to live on $15,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why they're at Harvard. And They don't want to make those sacrifices. But two, it's also, it strikes me as, again, unlikely to be the way you can do the most good if, even if you're thinking of it in purely mercenary terms of just how much money you can direct to good causes, the differential between you living as abstemiously as you can and you living pretty well doesn't represent nearly as much money as what you, I think, would be able to encourage in others and even get, you know, direct access to playing a slightly different game with your own wealth. I mean, the extreme case for me, again, is someone like Bill Gates, which is, like, you know, I can imagine, you know, however much he spends on himself, it really is just a rounding error on a rounding error with respect to his total wealth and the kinds of resources he can direct in the world. And, you know, so his time is not best spent figuring out how he can personally save money. His time is best spent making more and directing it in you know, multi-billion dollar chunks to good causes. Again, now leaving aside the systemic changes we might make in any tax code that we might agree is better than that. When you're talking about what one individual can do, it's not clear to me that following the Peter Singer line as closely as you're able and giving the maximum amount away is best in any individual's case, and certainly in any individual's case who's hoping to serve as some kind of moral contagion for others, mm-hmm. where you can provoke a willingness in others to emulate you.
So in the book, I talk a lot about the Quakers in the 18th century, and they remind me a little bit of effective altruists today.
Mm-hmm.
So the Quakers, they were this very weird, radical Protestant sect who deeply believed in the equality of all human beings. They saw that there was something of God in each and every one of us, and they were absolutely instrumental in driving the abolitionist movement forward. This was actually a bit of a surprise for me as an atheist, is that so much of the abolitionist energy came from a religious motivation, right? These people deeply believed in God, and they saw it as their religious duty to take on the fight against the slave trade and against mm-hmm. slavery. And initially, these Quakers, they didn't get all that much done. I mean, they were successful in convincing themselves. So at some point, they banned slavery among their own members. But most of society looked at them and were like, you guys are very weird, right? We can't work with you. Yeah. We'll just ignore you. The abolitionist movement really got going in the 1780s when the Quakers started working together with evangelicals and Anglicans. So Thomas Clarkson, who I already mentioned, he was from the official Anglican Church. Then you had people like William Wilberforce. He was an evangelical. And when that coalition was built of, on the one hand, these really radical, hardcore, EA-ish kind of Quakers who had also, by the way, made a lot of money. So 9 out of 12 founders of the British Society of the Abolition of the Slave Trade were Quakers, and 10 out of 12 were entrepreneurs, people who had built their own companies, skilled their own companies. And most of that wealth was Quaker wealth. But yeah, it really took off once they started allying with the much more mainstream, more charismatic evangelical movement, more like the normie Christians, if you will. And it always feels to me that we need something similar today. So what the evangelicals were for the Quakers, I think we need something similar to that with EA. Like, we don't need to dump EA or anything like that. I mean, EA just got to be EA. That's fine. It just won't appeal to most people because it's too weird, which is not bad. Like, it's not that the Quakers didn't have to convince everyone to be Quakers. They just had to play their role in the ecosystem.
Yep.
But at the same time, we got to build a much larger movement that appeals to, like, more normal people. I mean, for many EAs, it was this big discovery. Like, oh, you can actually be excited about doing good, you know? And for people like Will McCaskill and Toby Ord, they were like, oh, let's make this major pivot. And I was like, well, that's like, for most people, that's pretty obvious that doing good can make you happy. Mm. This is not some, like, fundamental insight or anything like that. Because they're so weird. And again, bless them for being weird. Sometimes we really need those weird people to drive us forward.
Speaking of weird people, you describe a school of charity entrepreneurship, I think, in London.
Yeah.
Which sounded very interesting because I'm wondering how much your organization is emulating that. It was essentially, you can describe it, but it was essentially an incubator for startup charities, recruiting young people with novel ideas and giving them funding. What is that, and how is your effort different?
It's one of the coolest organizations that I've ever visited. I like to describe it as the Hogwarts for do-gooders. Mm. You could also compare it to Y Combinator, you know, the prestigious incubator for startups in Silicon Valley, where people go to build these awesome companies that make a lot of money or hopefully become a unicorn. And at this charity incubator, they're trying to build the unicorns of doing good, of, you know, the most high impact charities. And the way they work is really, really interesting. They follow something that I like to describe as the Gandalf-Frodo model. So Gandalf never asked Frodo, hey, Frodo, what's your passion? Right? What do you want to do in the world? No, he said, this needs to be done. You throw the ring into the mountain and then we're all saved. So this is also how this school works. They work with researchers, they're Gandalfs, who do prioritization research, you know, who are continuously thinking about what are some of the most pressing, neglected issues that we face as a species, and where can small groups of committed people make a massive difference? Or what kind of high impact nonprofits do we need that don't exist today? I spoke to this woman called Lucia Coulter, and she's the founder of the Lead Exposure Elimination Project that is fighting lead poisoning around the globe. This is one of the most terrible global health problems that we face today, and very, very neglected because it's mostly solved in rich countries, but not in middle-income countries and lower-income countries where still hundreds of thousands of people die from it every year. But in a way, this is also kind of exciting because that means if you have a really good plan and you have a small group of very ambitious, dedicated idealists, you can make a massive difference. So Lucia, she was a doctor at the NHS. She loved her work. You know, she loved working with patients. At the same time, she felt this itch, like, I want to do more. She applied for charity entrepreneurship. She got in. And then the Gandalfs at the school said, look, this may sound weird, but we think lead poisoning, that's the thing. She founded this organization together with others. And yeah, they're active in more than a dozen countries. I have to visit the website again, probably for the latest number. And they already convinced the government of Malawi to properly regulate lead in paint. And if you do, you know, the calculations here, it's pretty astonishing. These people are doing the work of thousands of doctors now in terms of how much health and how many life years they are saving. It's in my view, incredibly exciting. And indeed, for us, that was very inspirational. So one of my co-founders at the School for Moral Ambition is an alumnus from charity entrepreneurship. And he co-founded an organization called Training for Good. And what they did, I like to describe it as the Robin Hood of talent model. So he was luring away tech talent out of Silicon Valley and convincing them to become Brussels-based lobbyists to advocate for a more balanced way of regulating AI. You know, what happened with social media is that, you know, it washed over us and there was very little resistance against big tech. People also had quite naive utopian ideas of how wonderful social media would be for us. And it seemed that that was going to happen again in Europe with AI, with, you know, very little proper regulation. But yeah, he managed to convince really talented people to join this fellowship, to join this small SWAT team to start working on it. And when I heard about that, I was like, this is awesome. Can't we scale this up, right? We need groups of brilliant corporate lawyers and marketeers to be fighting big tobacco. We need the best wealth managers and bankers we can find to advocate for a better tax system. We need brilliant doctors and engineers to be preparing us for the next pandemic, right? So yeah, I got really excited when I visited the school.
Nice. So are you also an incubator for charities, or are you just picking your causes and trying to fund them?
We're doing things a little bit differently. So on the one hand, we have our Moral Ambition Circle program. These are groups of 5 to 8 people who want to explore what moral ambition could mean for them. I mean, there are a lot of people. I mentioned this statistic of about 25% of people in the modern workforce who think that their own job might be socially meaningless. So a lot of people want to have these kind of conversations. And there are no single bullet solutions. You know, this is a pretty personal journey for a lot of us. So I think what often we got to do is to start to come together with like-minded people and explore the questions. Think about what are some of the most neglected issues? What are my personal superpowers? What's the match between those two? How can I take the first step? How can we hold each other accountable? I mean, the pledging part can also be quite powerful. We invite people to make a pledge at the end of the program to really take those first steps. And on the other hand, we have our fellowships, and those are highly selective, hard to get in. We've launched two of them already in Europe. We follow the same model as charity entrepreneurship does. So it wasn't me or any of my co-founders who decided the causes we would work on. We employed a couple of researchers who spent 1,000 hours with a long list of big global problems and then stack ranking them. And one of my big surprises was that they advised us, because we do policy entrepreneurship in Europe, you know, so mainly using Brussels as a big lever for change. We were advised to start working on tobacco control and fighting big tobacco. I was not that excited about it initially, I gotta admit. This was not my big passion. I thought we had already solved it. A little bit similar to what you describe with malaria, right? It's like not like suddenly your heart starts beating like, yeah, let's destroy Philip Morris. I was like, we've already done that, right? Turns out, no. This is the single largest preventable cause of disease, 8 million deaths. It's the most deadly object in the history of humanity that was ever invented in terms of casualties, much bigger than the machine gun or atomic bombs. It's a jumbo jet crashing every 30 minutes, a fully loaded jumbo jet. And this is not free choice at all. I mean, free choice, you know, I agree that it doesn't exist anyway. But even if you are like a compatibilist, you got to agree here that, I mean, most kids, people start smoking when they're still kids, right? About 80%. The industry very deliberately targets people when they're young. And yeah, then it takes on average about 30 stop attempts. So smoking is as addictive as heroin. So I don't know, once you start reading up on it, it's a little bit like a fish seeing water for the first time. Suddenly you see that this is the most evil legal industry out there. Today, there's a lot of moral outrage for something like smartphone and TikTok, right? Oh, these are so bad for our kids, right? They get addicted to it. And then I'm like, well, imagine a smartphone that is super addictive, but it also kills you. Well, that's a cigarette. And most people are like, that's just the way it is. So anyway, what was really interesting to see is that we started recruiting people and the pitch was, you're going to work with a small group of extremely talented people. So it's very hard to get into this. But yeah, we're not really going to tell you yet what you're going to work on, or at least there will be two options. Another fellowship we're doing is on the food transition, accelerating the transition towards sustainable proteins, accelerating the development of clean meat, for example, which is the most neglected part of the fight against climate change, and obviously also connected to the greatest moral atrocity of our time, which is factory farming. But as you can imagine, when we had these 24 people who were accepted for the first two fellowships, almost all of them wanted to work on the food thing because food is sexy, right? Food is cool, it's startups, it's new technology. But then we had to say to half of them, like, no, you're actually going to work on fighting big tobacco. Well, you got to talk to them today because they are so passionate about it right now. I don't think they're about to get a tattoo. But once you start seeing it, you can become very passionate about the task that Gandalf has given you. And I promise that I won't make any fantasy metaphors anymore in this conversation. But that's the way we work. And it's quite exciting, to be honest.
That's great. And presumably you're a 501c3 and people can donate to the school?
Yep. And everything I earn with the book, all of that is going into the movement. We've even received a little bit of money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Maybe I should have disclosed that. It's only 1% of our budget, but we're very proud of that.
Nice. So you have been a big proponent of universal basic income. Has your thought evolved on that topic at all? Do you have any concerns about the social, ethical, psychological status implications of implementing it?
It was absolutely amazing to see the epidemic of basic income experiments in the last decade. So when I first wrote about it, 2014, basic income was a quite obscure, forgotten idea. You had a few people like Dylan Matthews in the US, for example, for Vox.com writing about it. But it was mainly happening on these blogs. And today it's really entered the mainstream. A lot of people know what it is. They know that it's a policy option on the table, even though it still seems too radical and utopian for most. What was also exciting to see how it has managed to break through the political divide, right? There have been quite a few people on the right being interested in it, also quite a few people on the left being interested in it. And I think for good reasons. We have a lot more evidence now on cash transfers and how they work and when they work. The evidence from poor countries and middle-income countries has been extraordinarily positive, especially for poorer countries. You've got this amazing NGO called GiveDirectly.
Right.
They've given hundreds of millions of dollars to extremely poor people in very poor countries, and it just works incredibly well. I think they've shown that cash should be the benchmark in development aid. But whenever you want to help poor people in poor countries, you should always ask yourself the question, why am I building this school here? You know, I could also just donate the money. Or whenever you're driving around in an SUV in, I don't know, Malawi, you could wonder, like, maybe I should just have sold this SUV and given it to people here, because probably that would have been much more effective, right? The burden of proof is very high. I think that there are some interventions, such as insecticide-treated malaria bed nets, that are probably even more cost-effective. But yeah, as I said, cash is now the benchmark. For richer countries, the evidence is a bit more mixed. So recently, we had a big new study funded by OpenAI, a bunch of brilliant economists who did an insanely rigorous study. And yeah, it was a bit underwhelming, to be honest. I had hoped for better results. But I got to be honest here, got to be intellectually honest. Yeah, it wasn't the effects were
underwhelming in what sense? Economically or, say, the social consequences of it, or the psychological consequences?
So the positive social effects were fairly limited. The effect sizes there were small or non-existent. And yeah, there was a quite significant drop in how much people worked, which you could argue is the point. It's maybe especially in the age of AI, when the robots will take our jobs, maybe we can finally figure out what life is about, right? And that's actually not a bug, but a feature of basic income, that people spend less time in their BS jobs and they do things that they actually find interesting. This was honestly always the dream of, you know, some of the greatest economists.
Well, that's what aristocrats have been doing for centuries, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They found that use for leisure. Yeah.
John Maynard Keynes wrote this fantastic essay almost 100 years ago about the 15-hour work week that we would have in 2030. And it hasn't happened for a very long time. Up until the 60s and the 70s, the work week was shrinking around the West. But ever since then, that has stagnated. And in some countries like the US, people have actually been working a little bit more, especially if you look at it from the household level. Women have also entered the workforce, and people are pretty stressed out. So I think basic income gives us a different vision of the kind of economy we could have. I believe we should never underestimate capitalism's extraordinary ability to come up with new jobs that perhaps don't really need to exist. I mean, currently the number is 25%. I think there's no reason it couldn't be 50% or 60%. If we hang on to this ideology that you have to work for your money, otherwise you're not like a worthy human being, maybe at some point we will have to move past that ideology. It was a good ideology for a long time when we still needed it, you know, when people were working in farms and factories, when that was necessary to generate the wealth that we all rely on. But maybe we're going to move towards a world where most wealth will be created by the robots and by AI. And it would be very dystopian if we then still hang on to old, outdated ideas, like you're not a good person if you don't have a job.
Yeah, no, it's humbling to consider the challenge posed even by the most benign and successful possibilities of AI, right? So let's say AI has none of the downside risk that many of us are worried about. There's no alignment problem. Bad actors don't use it to destroy humanity. It's just like a gift from God, just pulling wealth out of the ether. Even under those conditions, we seem politically and ethically and socially unprepared to absorb all of that goodness, because status is, and one's just sense of having a place in the world is so clearly linked to work for most people.
Yeah. Look, I wish there were more White Mirror series on Netflix or HBO or whatever. I think we can all see that there are very clear dystopian possibilities and that the future could be very dark. In a way, we're already seeing it in other countries like China with their massive surveillance systems.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the future could be so, so much better. And I've again, been frustrated quite often with my friends on the left. Whenever they hear tech, they think about billionaires with their vanity projects shooting themselves up in space. And it's super fashionable to be a tech critic. But if I study history, I see that very often technology has liberated us. So, for example, the modern women's rights movement, it's unthinkable without technology. First, it was the bicycle, for example, that was so liberating for women. People like Susan B. Anthony loved bikes. You know, it was It's like, oh, suddenly we can go everywhere. Or in the book, I talk quite extensively about the invention of Inovid, the birth control pill. And not a lot of people know this, but this invention didn't come out of nowhere. It was very deliberately invented and financed by Catherine McCormick, who was a radical suffragette who was obsessed with giving women the control over their own fertility. And in the 1950s, she just started looking for a crazy scientist who could do it. Now, even Planned Parenthood, a pretty controversial organization at the time, even they wouldn't want to touch this. And so at some point, she found a researcher, George Pincus, who had been kicked out of Harvard for his controversial research. And he said, yeah, I can probably do it. And she gave him, $2 million?
Yeah.
So he basically said, like, yeah, I've got unlimited money for you until you get me this thing. And indeed, a few years later, he developed Inovid. And that thing was so revolutionary. It changed the world so radically that today we just call it the pill.
Mm-hmm.
And we find it really hard to even imagine a world where women don't have that brilliant, wonderful control over their own fertility.
Mm. Well, give us time. Give us time here in America.
Okay.
The stirrings of theocracy can be heard.
Good point. You see my point, right? We should get better at seeing the beautiful possibilities of technology.
Yeah.
And I would love to read more about that. I want to see more series about how an AI future could also be really, really good.
Well, to not take your direction there and close on a potentially depressing note, what are the the sources of existential risk that most concern you at present, if you had to prioritize our attention to what's blocking the path to some of these more utopian possibilities?
So unlike my EA friends, I don't have the same obsession with AI. It's just because I'm deeply uncertain. I just don't really see what the effective interventions are here.
Yeah.
I also think that, ironically, EAs have sped up the development of AI by quite a bit, just by talking about it a lot. And some people who were really celebrated in AI circles are now, or in EA circles, they're now AI accelerationists because, they think we got to beat China. So I don't know. And also in terms of regulating it, I'm honestly just deeply confused. Maybe this is all above my paycheck. So I would rather talk about something like pandemic prevention, where it seems so, so clear to me that the next pandemic may be just around the corner and it could be so much worse. And the world is spending almost nothing on it, right? We spend $1 billion each year on researching emerging infectious diseases like Zika or Ebola, which is as much as Americans spend bleaching their teeth every year. That's the funniest comparison I could find.
Yeah, that's a good one.
No, that's bizarre, right? So we need so much more talent to be thrown at this problem. And again, for me, there's a deep connection between the distribution of wealth and the distribution of talent. There's one study that I also reference in the book that shows that as tax rates for the rich have been going down since the 60s and 70s, we've also seen this talent shift. You know, more and more people have been going to Wall Street or to Silicon Valley and then often working in jobs that, again, are building startups that are not super socially valuable and are super good at making our kids addicted to silly apps. And yeah, that for me is what moral ambition is all about. It's about using what you have, your talent, your skill set, your money, your network, your precious time on this earth to make the biggest possible difference and make this world a wildly better place.
Well, Rutger, it's a great topic you've chosen to evangelize about. It's, I mean, arguably the most important one. Again, the book is Moral Ambition. Tell people where they can find out more about the school.
That's on moralambition.org. We've got our fellowships opening up already in Europe. We're recruiting a new cohort, and we're also going to start fellowships globally. So a tax fairness fellowship that's going to be for fellows in Canada, the US, and the EU. And we're also going to work on accelerating the transition towards sustainable food in the US. So, oh, and by the way, I should also have mentioned this. I think you'll find this interesting. We're organizing a Business for Good conference with Peter Singer, the man himself, in Amsterdam.
Nice.
This is one thing I'm honestly really excited about, this movement of entrepreneurs who also pledge to donate a big chunk of their wealth, of their income, of their earnings to highly effective charities. So we're playing our role in trying to accelerate that movement. And together with Charity Entrepreneurship, we're also launching a so-called Founding to Give incubator. And here are the ideas that we're recruiting, again, very driven young entrepreneurs who want to build a very valuable for-profit startup, you know, aspire to build this unicorn. But with one catch, they pledge to donate at least 50% of the money they make when they eventually sell the company.
Nice.
So not like the giving pledge of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, where have a lot of people pledging and we're still waiting. There's not a lot of giving happening there. No, you really pledge to do it as soon as you sell the company. Because honestly, this is the reason why so many of these problems are currently not being solved. Is there's no business model for them. And ever since I started this, I became much more interested in money. Maybe one final quote from Margaret Thatcher here. The Good Samaritan, he didn't just have good intentions. He also had money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to close the loop on an earlier topic, I think once we can spread the meme that status is, you know, indelibly associated with these kinds of outcomes, right? I mean, so to be a founder with a, you know, $1 billion exit is one thing. To be a founder with $1 billion exit where you have pledged to give 50% away to the most effective charities is a very different thing. And it should be just for aspiration for rank status alone, it should be obviously the more attractive outcome.
Absolutely. I mean, these British abolitionists who founded the British Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade, the reason I'm still writing about them today as a historian more than two centuries later is not because they were rich.
Right.
I've met a lot of rich people in my life, and most of them are a bit boring, I have to say. No, the reason we remember those guys is because they devoted their wealth, their talent, their skill set to fighting the most pressing moral catastrophe of their time, and they made a massive difference. And that's why we keep writing books about them.
Yeah. Well, Rutger, thanks again. Great to finally meet you.
Thanks for having me, Sam.